And
there are no amendments, and I think Senator Shoemaker has gotten his question answered, remember?
What? I don't even know.
You had a question about 2429. Has recommendation. Discussion? Call the roll, please, Pat.
Senator Brenneman?
Aye.
Brockman?
Aye.
Rinsky? Hill? Shoemaker?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. I don't think I have any time. This is work session anyway. Oh, actually, we don't have
no amendments.
Representative Peterson is not here. We'll try to send for her. Representative Bunn had comments on 3094, so we might send a note to Representative Bunn's staff, who had testimony last time, if I recall. Are there folks here on 27? Do we have sign-up sheets? 2769 relating to assigned contracts.
I think we do.
Can't table that. No. The Bronner's bill. Another one of Bronner's bill.
Is it?
No, I don't know. Oregon Bankers.
Frank is here. 2769, public hearing and possible work session.
Okay.
Sorry, we have a number of legislators scattered around the building who want to be heard on some of these bills. It's really hard to sort of track everybody down at the right time. Frank, 2769.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Frank Bronner with the Oregon Bankers Association, State Chartered Banks of Oregon. ORS 20097 provides that a person who assigns a contract may be liable for attorney fees if the person to whom the contract is assigned later sues on the contract and loses. This is as it should be if the contract did not represent a valid claim at the time of the assignment. A recent court case in Eastern Oregon, however, has interpreted 20097 as providing that the person who assigns a contract will be liable for attorney fees even if the contract represented a valid claim at the time of the assignment. In the case of Thiel versus the United States National Bank, in the case cited for you, the court held that the assigner was liable for attorney fees even though it was the action of the assignee which rendered the contract invalid. House Bill 2769 is intended to clarify that the liability of the assigner for attorney fees shall exist only if the claim evidenced by the assigned contract was defective at the time of the assignment. Madam Chair, members, we urge the passage of 2769. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Senator Springer.
Frank, do I understand that this was just some district or circuit court decision that hasn't been appealed or may be appealed? Or
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, the bank involved decided not to appeal. They were surprised. What literally happened is that they had the parents, dairy farmers in Eastern Oregon. The parents were co-signed on a note with son and daughter-in-law. There were two divorces involved and two bankruptcies involved. The co-signers paid off the loan, and thus the bank assigned the loan to the parents. The parents proceeded against property of the daughter-in-law. Years passed.
Family farming.
It was
dispute, huh?
And frankly, the daughter-in-law prevailed, and not only that, then brought suit against the bank I think, 2 years afterwards for attorney fees and was successful. We don't think we're trying to change what was the intent of the law. We think we're trying to clarify. If you'd like, I can get you a copy of the case, Senator Springer. It's a rather interesting case, and I think it's probably would never happen again, but since it happened, we'd like to clarify.
I would be curious in reading the case. Thank you.
Senator Schumacher.
You need a chart to figure out who's who in reading the case, yes.
I have one question, Frank. I noticed that the responsibility for attorney's fees turns on whether the defense that was asserted existed at the time of the assignment of the contract. And it seems to me that a more relevant date is whether it existed at the time of the commencement of the suit.
Well, in the Madam Chair, Senator Schumacher, in the case, at the time of the transfer or the assignment, it was clearly indicated that the bank had been, the obligation had been satisfied insofar as the bank was concerned, and they were assigning the contract. The suit was not commenced for, I believe, a year or so afterwards.
Mm-hmm. That the bank
believed, the bank believed when they assigned the contract, inasmuch as they had been satisfied completely, that they were completely absolved of any further action, and the action was then between the borrower and the cosigners, in this case, the parents.
Mm-hmm. Let me see. So in that suit, it wouldn't be fair to make the bank liable.
That always be true, though? That always, the amendment that you propose always be fair? I guess I don't know enough about the law to track it through and see what the permutations are, but I mean, you could imagine a situation where...
Madam Chair, Senator Schumacher, if you don't know enough about the law, I certainly am not going to be able to respond.
I'm not familiar with the law.
We believe that what we're suggesting in this bill has always been the law. We believe that when an assignment is made, when the obligation has been satisfied, that person is completely out of the transaction. The transaction then is between the parties still involved. We think it would always be fair.
Well, let me, I don't, that's why I think maybe reading the case might be helpful.
Be happy to
provide
the case.
I don't have any hands-on experience in this area. But let me ask, on the House side, or is this the first time this has been up for hearing here?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who else we've got. Has anybody from the State Bar, the business section, or the credit or debtor section had a chance to review this to your knowledge or make any comments?
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, nobody appeared in opposition on the House side, and we did provide, and were requested to, and I intended to have it with me, a copy of the case for each member to review, and I'd be happy to do that. I'm sorry that I didn't do that today.
The other question, if I may, is I don't think I've seen a section quite like Section 2 before, where you say that this amendment does not constitute a change in but is declaratory of existing law and shall apply to all contracts on before ever existed, may ever exist?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Springer, I'm told by legislative counsel there are other, that it is not precedent.
Wouldn't be the first time.
It would not be the first time.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I guess it's all right.
Well, we can hold this over till people get a chance to look at the date, look at the cases, as long as you've got it, and we'll bring it up on probably Friday.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Bunn is here on House Bill 3094. Is that correct? Representative, we're not sure which bill are, belong to whom these days, but they just keep coming. 3094, folks. It has to do with ethics, if I recall correctly.
Madam Chair and members of the House, for your record, my name is Stan Bunn, and I represent District 29 in the House, and I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 3094. And I'd like to give you a bit of the perspective that I come from as I introduced and support this bill. I had the opportunity to serve as a member of and chairman of the Ethics Commission. And during that period of time, the primary complaints dealt with members of small city councils or planning commissions or those sorts of groups. And the complaint often came in a hand-scribbled letter to the Ethics Commission complaining about the conduct of the public official, and very broad in its terms, and indicated that there should be an investigation. And I remember particularly the frustration I felt in reviewing both valid complaints that were very clear in the nature of the complaint, and in fact findings that the public official had carried out misconduct, but a large number of cases that in my mind ultimately ended in a finding of no wrongdoing, in which a public official that had served in a city council for 15 or 20 years would say to the commission, I just want you to know I'll never serve in the public office again because it's simply not worth it to go through this kind of process. And my sense was that there were a number of cases where, if you will, it was sort of a witch hunt by a disgruntled citizen. And I think that to the degree we can diminish or minimize that kind of thing, it's beneficial. And the bill very simply does four things. It says, first, that when there is a complaint, the Ethics Commission will notify the party complained about before they make public disclosure or give that information to the press. Two, that there will be a finding of probable cause before they go on with the hearing. Three, that there will be specified in writing exactly what the complaint is. And finally, that if there is an investigation, that investigation will report both the good information obtained and the bad information obtained. And the bill was designed to try to protect the need for open and public process, but at the same time say, we want to simply give a procedural protection to the accused person. There has been a suggestion that since the time I served on the commission, some of these problems have been taken care of, or if they haven't been taken care of, they can be taken care of by rule. The comments I've gotten from people who have experienced that process of the Ethics Commission since my service there indicates that there are still problems, and it's my feeling that the protections we feel are reasonable should be built into the statute. I would make one comment on line 10 of the bill. It requires notification of the public official. I had suggested to the committee in the House that we provide for good faith attempts to notify. The House committee wanted to be a little more stringent on the matter than I did and left it as it was. But I would again say that I have no objection to requiring a good faith attempt to notify so that if there's a problem with actual notification, it doesn't stall the process. With that, I would strongly urge your adoption of the bill, and I would be glad to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thanks, Representative Bunn. Are there questions?
When would be the circumstance that you couldn't notify a public official? They're supposed to be very hard to find.
Well, my concern is that if you have I certainly don't want to say obscure, but if you have a member of a commission or some small body that is on not in the area at the time and the press is beating at the door of the Ethics Commission, I wasn't sure that we should say that the Ethics Commission has to wait for a long period of time. And frankly, my suggestion for the change came because I think Betty Reynolds had expressed a concern about
she
that
will,
provision.
She signed up to testify, okay. And we'll hear from her.
And I just wanted to signal this committee Great. That I'm flexible on that issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you. The other questions? Comments? Thanks. See you a little bit later. Betty?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Betty Reynolds. I'm director of the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. Bob Ingalls is vice chair, would be here today. He's a former legislator, but he was unavailable. The commission has reviewed the bill and believes that its existing procedures provide the safeguards that are proposed and might even exceed due process requirements. For example, prior to conducting an investigation, the commission provides the respondent a copy of the complaint with a notice and an explanation of the commission's procedures and a copy of the statutes. Prior to any hearing or meeting on a complaint, the commission provides a copy of its findings and another explanation of the procedures, and it's a very open process where all parties are invited to comment. I think the objectivity of the commission's investigations and proceedings is attested to by the fact that the commission actions are rarely appealed, and in the 15 years of the commission's existence, none of its actions have been overturned. The commission, after 15 years, finally has a full-time investigator. That person is an attorney, and he does review all complaints with professional objectivity and fairness. Finally, the bill as drafted, the commission is concerned that it has potential for causing delay. That is, the commission is a citizen commission created by the electorate. It meets approximately every 4 to 6 weeks. If the commission were required to, for example, find probable cause prior to initiating an investigation, or were required to deliberate before expanding the scope of an investigation.
Excuse me, but don't you do that as a staff person before you bring it to the commission?
Madam Chair.
Isn't that possible for you to have a rule authorizing you to bring notice to people to say there's been a request being filed, an investigation will be undertaken? I mean, I don't understand why that's a problem.
Madam Chair,
you do all sorts of investigation, hasn't it?
Madam Chair, the Commission's existing administrative rules provide that the Commission, the only basis for determining not to conduct an investigation is to determine there's no probable cause. It's a double negative, but in essence, the staff reviews a complaint, decides whether there's jurisdiction and sufficient specificity so that we can proceed and bring the preliminary findings to the commission with a probable cause recommendation. We're pleased that with the full-time compliance manager, we have been able to exceed the legislatively approved turnaround time of 150 days. It's even less than that. And the commission's concern is that the bill as drafted may cause delay. But Senator Cohen, you are correct. The staff does make that determination at this point.
Further comments?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Brennan.
When did that particular routine go into effect?
Madam Chair, Senator Brennan, it's an administrative rule. I've been director since 1979, and it was an existing administrative rule at that time. So I'm sorry I can't provide the exact date, but it's been at least 10 years.
Well, I was pretty close to one of the investigation of a friend of mine that didn't quite go. Since 79, it didn't quite go on that exact frame.
Senator Hill.
Thank you. Betty, I wanted to ask you about the scope of the investigations. It seems as though what tends to happen is that sort of starts out investigating one thing, and then it's kind of one thing that leads to another, and then you end up going through sometimes going through somebody's entire life and looking for everything. Now, what about, do you notify someone when the scope of the investigation is going to broaden?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, the respondent is provided with a copy of the complaint letter and is provided with notice. The complaints are often generally stated, alleging violation of, for example, the Code of Ethics, use of office for personal gain. Ordinarily, the investigation would be conducted sufficient to gather evidence to assist the commission in determining whether there's cause to believe a violation that may have occurred. if other allegations within the commission's jurisdiction come to light, they may be included, but it's ordinarily confined to the matters alleged.
I'm sure my... With respect to investigations that are going on and how public those investigations become, what are you required to, what does the press have access to when you have an ongoing investigation?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, I'm glad you asked that question. I think the commission, some of the concerns about the commission's proceedings have to do with the fact that it's all of its records are specifically designated public records, both in Chapter 171, the lobby regulation laws, Chapter 244, government ethics laws, and their public records pursuant to Chapter 192. If we do claim any confidentiality exceptions, they're only those that are authorized under Chapter 192. So the answer is our records are specifically designated public records, and the files are open files.
Including your records of your investigators as well?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, yes. As you know, Chapter 192 does provide certain exceptions to investigations. The Ethics Commission is not one of those agencies exempted.
Madam Chair?
Go ahead.
I know it's a real delicate line, but what seems to happen is that, for example, when someone is investigating, they will get someone's statements that may or may not be factual. The investigator just goes around and asks people what they think. And see, there really, for public officials, there's two things going on. Number one is it's a very, very much of a legal process determining whether someone is guilty or innocent. But we also are very susceptible to what happens in the press. And there's so much that can be made of what happens that by the time it's all done, it doesn't matter whether you've been found guilty or innocent because you've already been splattered across the press and usually by the time you're found innocent, and maybe this is a matter with the press, they always put that in somewhere in the back page that nothing came of it. Do you have any way or any plan to try to address that kind of situation?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, the commission administers the laws under its jurisdiction. Exempting the commission's records from the public meetings law, the public records law, is not part of our package, but I would respectfully suggest that would be a way to remedy the problem. I did bring the commission.
Can I interrupt a minute? The open records law does still require a request for disclosure. 192 still says you have to go and ask, and you can turn them down for purposes of confidentiality for a week or whatever until you finalize whatever you're doing. I mean, I think there can be good reasons for you not to disclose at a particular time, particular information that's being asked for. So it's not as if somebody can walk into your office and demand. I mean, you can refuse under some grounds and in some circumstances. Do you refuse? I just want people to be clear on what 192 does.
Yes, Madam Chair, we have refused and have gone through the process where the Department of Justice makes a determination regarding the confidentiality.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else who signed up to speak on House Bill 3094? Eric Carlson.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Eric Carlson with the League of Oregon Cities. Mm-hmm. We have a record. We have a letter that's been placed in your file on this. We support 3094 as is. It is our feeling that 3094 sets out appropriate broad standards for the commission to do its work. Its process is as important as the substance of the work it does. We think those standards that are set forth belong in statute after public debate in this kind of a forum. I should tell you that in connection with another bill, I went to look at the Ethics Commission's rules, with the exception of a couple of minor changes. They have not been changed since 1980, and this is in the face of a bill that was passed in the 1987 session that made a significant number of changes in the ethics law. So I'm not, the Ethics Commission is not on top of its own rules process, and I think it's appropriate that these kind of standards get set in the statute to guide them in their own internal processes. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you, Eric.
Madam Chair, I'll make a motion to send 394 to the floor with a due pass. 3094.
Okay. Senator Brenneman has moved House Bill 3094 to the floor with a due pass recommendation of the discussion. That's not what his motion is. Discussion? Call the roll, please.
Senator Brenneman?
Aye.
Brockman?
Aye.
Krinsky?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Shoemaker?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much, Senator Brenneman. Carry this. Okay, let's move to, is Nancy Peterson here? She's probably down in Ways and Means with all the crisis going on. Yes, helping. Let's take up 3068, and then we'll get Jack in to do work session and go on down the list. 3068 is a bill that comes to us from Senator Hill's committee. It's here for discussion of the triple damages, I think. Not as to... Right. Ruth Ann Mogan, Barry Amson, the Oregon PUD Association, whoever you want to bring up, Sandra Bishop, Bob Hall. I want to thank you for waiting around a second day. Appreciate your being willing to understand.
Thank you. Ms. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sandra Bishop. I'm here representing the Oregon People's Utility District Association. And I have with me today Ruth Ann Mogan, who is our executive director for the PUD Association, and also Barry Adamson, who is an attorney here representing the PUD Association, to answer any questions. So Ms. Mogan is going to go ahead and start testimony, and I'll pass out that.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ruth Ann Mogan, and I'm executive director of the Oregon PUD Association. We represent all six of the PUDs in the state of Oregon. Current Oregon statute does not provide an adequate deterrent to reduce the theft of utility service. The result is that honest utility customers pay for power that is stolen, and utility employee safety is put at risk. In today's scenario, the following happens. We discover that a customer has willfully tampered with an electric meter. We then ask the district attorney to prosecute for a criminal penalty under ORS 164.125. The utility must then prove the actual loss. The best method is to place a check meter ahead of the suspect's meter. After about 1 week, we have enough information to estimate the difference between actual use and recorded use. Although our records may indicate that the meter had been recording inaccurately for a long time, there is no way to prove it. Other factors besides meter tampering could indicate a dramatic change in power usage, so we cannot prove that there's the extent of the theft of service. Emerald PUD in Lane County has 75 to 80 known theft of service incidences each year. To put that number into perspective, Emerald PUD serves approximately 13,700 total customers. They were recently alerted to a possible theft of power, with the power being diverted from a residence to a nearby barn. They placed a check meter on the residence for 13 days. The check meter indicated usage of 282.47 kilowatt hours per day. The records from the residence meter indicated usage of 58.47 kilowatt hours a day. That's approximately 230-some kilowatt hours difference. The cost of the unmetered usage of electricity was $8,531.15. To Through the court system, Emerald was allowed to collect $1,508, the amount substantiated by the check meter. The dollars that customers saved on electricity certainly added to the profitability of his marijuana crop. I have attached a more detailed description of the case that is attached to my testimony. National surveys indicate the estimated annual cost of electricity theft from the nation's utilities anywhere from $1.7 to $4 billion. On a national average, each of the 100 million consumers in the United States pays from $17 to $40 annually to offset losses due to theft by less than 1% of the utility's customers. Several of Oregon's PUDs are in the process of updating and modernizing all customer metering within their systems. The risk to utility employees working with tampered meters is great. We want to further protect those employees by making abusers aware of both the criminal and civil consequences if they tamper with their meter to divert electricity. House Bill 3068 allows for treble damages for the theft of utility service. It puts potential violators on notice that we will protect the majority of our customers, the honest ones, as well as the safety of our employees from the abuser who steals electricity. Along with my testimony, I have provided a summary of the bill's
anyone here from Representative Peterson's office? I guess not. Come on, Catherine, why don't you just pass out the amendment and we'll go through the bill. Just
go through the bill. I just passed the amendment out.
I know.
Right.
Or I'll go through the bill.
Okay, the bill enacts provisions concerning easements.
And paying for upkeeping, maintenance for easements, right?
Right. Yes, Senator.
It has to do with maintenance of easements, talking about combination if an owner refuses to maintain their easement.
Okay, I can
go through the
The measure specifically requires all owners of a right-of-way to share the cost of maintaining the right-of-way based on each owner's use of the easement. It also sets forth the provisions for determining how costs would be shared, and it applies prospectively. And I'm not sure if the amendment changes that or not.
It is very much more prospective. It's existing on or created after October 1, 1989. I guess it goes back. It's existing. It's easements existing on October 1, 1989. So it takes away the prospective part. The amendment would do that. If I read it, Eric Carlson, you want to come up, Eric? Is he here? Eric has gone away too. Let's set this bill aside then to another day. And turn to Jack. You're finished, right?
Yes, sir.
Well, we have members here. Let's do work session, House Bill 2294.
House Bill 2294 is at the request of the Department of State Police. There's one relatively minor amendment I'll pass out to you in the next time.
This is the designated agency issue, if you recall. And we had testimony from BPST to say that they wanted to be added to the list of designated agencies that would have direct access to the LEDs. NCIC information, which included other states.
Actually, I think they want to become a law enforcement.
Right,
agency.
That's
correct.
But that's
right.
That would allow them the direct access right to the NCIC.
Move the amendment.
Senator Springer is moving House Bill 2294-1 amendments. Is there other objections? Is so ordered.
Move the bill as amended to pass.
Senator Springer moves House Bill 2294 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Discussion? Call the roll, please, Pat.
Senator Brenneman?
Aye.
Brockman?
Aye.
Brinsky?
Aye.
Hill? Shoemaker?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Aye, motion carried, thank you. Let's move to 2357.
That is at request of various members of the legislature. This is the bill addressed to the requirement that an inmate stay in the county of, use the term loosely, residence when he's out on temporary leave. As a result of our public hearing, there was one issue that I believe Senator Shoemaker raised, and I'll pass out an amendment that addresses that at this time. You may recall that the bill, as it reads now, would appear to require the Department of Corrections to waive the requirement if the inmate asks. So this amendment simply changes that language from shall to may.
And that has to do with moving out of state, if I recall correctly.
Right, yeah.
Senator Springer?
Madam Chair, I think we first had our hearing on this last week or earlier this week.
Right.
And I recall some of the discussion, but I'm not sure if we discussed specifically, maybe Senator Shoemaker or others can help me out. I happen to live in a jurisdiction, Multnomah County, which has, in terms of its population, we are find that the number of serious crimes as well as the number of commitments, prosecutions, exceeds what one would expect in terms of our crime rates in other counties based on population. I think, unfortunately, the reason for that is that Portland, like a lot of metropolitan areas, it tends to be the focal point where crimes get done by people who may not actually be residents of that county. They may have committed their criminal activity. They may have robbed the bank in Portland. Well, they may have done the drug deal in Portland. They may have done the prostitution. Unfortunately, cities are where these things happen, and I'm not sure that the way we've dealt with residents, I appreciate the reason the bill's here. Obviously, Marion County has borne more than its share of folks on temp leave, but I got to kind of look out for the interests of my own county here, too, and I'm just not sure we've explored what the impact would be in the circumstances I've described.
Well, I suppose you don't go back to where you commit your crime. You'd have to go back to the resident, where you were a resident. So I guess that's a piece that's different.
Mm-hmm.
That would at least, if someone came from Salem and committed the crime in Portland, you'd still be sending them back to Salem, I think. Now, correct me, Jack, if I'm in error.
That's correct. That language on the Ann Gross version of the bill is starting on line 11. Residency means the last address of record as determined in descending order by the driver's license, records maintained by the Department of Revenue, records maintained by the state police, records by the Department of Human Resources. And then only after those are exhausted do you get down to where the offense occurred.
So I think at least there's been an attempt made to resolve that particular issue, and the issue that said you have to go back to the county of residence was, and I don't know whether you missed part of the testimony or not, they alleged at least that they made it county because they didn't feel that they would want to send someone back to their exact neighborhood if it were contraindicated or whatever. So those are the two pieces that at least I recall from various testimony, and we were in and out that day, and it was a rushed testimony, admittedly.
Well, I think the definition that counsel has pointed out probably speaks, albeit indirectly, to my concern, although I'm not sure. I think we know that at any given time, I guess, is 10% of the licenses are in a suspended status, and even though you're required by law to notify the Motor Vehicles Division of a change in your address, I know there are just tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people who haven't notified DMV of their current address, but that's enough said on that subject, perhaps. I don't know if my concern has been fully addressed, but...
I'm happy to take a little more time if you want to explore something. I saw this bill come in, and without the amendments that were made significant in the House, I was prepared to just not deal with it very positively, but I think they've made some efforts. Senator Grinsky.
Well, I agree. Look, the amendments are definitely better than what, the way this bill first showed up, but it seems to me that there's a certain artificialness, if that's the way to put it, to just saying, let's send them back to where they came from. The person may have been in the prison for 5 years or something. A lot of things have changed in that amount of time. And now they're out on temporary leave, so we decide that it's best to send them back where they were residing at the time when they were arrested 5 years ago or 10 years ago or whatever. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily conducive to them not committing more crimes. I'm not sure that it isn't either. But there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of discretion unless you fall into these categories of having a biological family that resides somewhere else, or you have a full-time job, or, you know, if you don't fall into those categories, you're going back there. And it seems to me there could be a lot of other circumstances that might need to be considered. That's my only concern with it.
Well, I'm happy to hold the bill over a little longer if you all want to think you can sort it out more. I didn't want to hang around any longer unless we had some ideas that we thought we might want to work on. That's fine.
Madam Chair?
Senator Shoemaker.
If the sentencing guidelines become law, this won't be... This bill won't have much effect, will it?
Well, they come out on post-conviction relief.
This is a temporary leave.
Well,
and it has to be in excess of 30 days. And I thought they're going to cut temp leave of the...
This is... We've got both of them. One applies to temporary leave, and the other one applies to parole.
Oh, I thought there was a parole.
Yeah, they're both here. They're 24-36 is the other one related to parole. So... they are both companions, and they are we need to ask staff to look these over, because as Senator, as Representative Maddox suggested, the language is different, and he thought the language was better in 2357.
I have an amendment drafted to make them try.
Okay, good.
Ask a question which might help
sure,
me.
Sure, Senator Grinsky.
What happens now when these people are released on temporary leave? Are they free to go wherever they want? As long as they're in the state.
Someone here from the Corrections Division?
Jack, do you know?
I believe they are, Senator.
As long as they come back and stay in the state during their 30 days or whatever.
I believe so, although I'm not certain.
Okay.
Senator Springer.
Has anybody taken a tough look at the whether or not we're going to run into constitutional problems? I realize that a court can impose a lot of conditions. I don't know about what test is applied to a condition imposed as part of temporary leave as it relates to residency.
I think you need to ask the question for both temporary leave and release issue, whether you call it parole or police.
I think the courts kind of look at this residency issue and your ability to move across state lines. And I think there's a pretty high test when we try to tell somebody they can live or have to live somewhere. And I think we're just inviting a challenge, and I'm not sure we're on very good grounds.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator
Elk. Chair, there was this recent Supreme Court case that just the other day that had to do with, sentencing, I believe, that said that... it said that the corrections officials had great latitude. I think it had to do with visitation, I believe is what it had to do with, and determining who could come and visit, who could visit an inmate. And I think that, but the language, at least in the the story on the decision gave corrections officials a great deal of latitude in allowing for those kinds of things. And there has been a steady trend with the courts of cutting back and back and back and back on inmates' rights. Now, whether agree with it or not, that certainly has been the trend. And so I would at least have that.
Why don't you come up, please? And I don't want to take a lot more time at it, but come on up, introduce yourself, and if you have...
Yes, for the record, my name is Mark Wiener, and I am the legislative assistant to Representative Mannix. Just on the point that Senator Springer brought up, there was a considerable amount of discussion on the constitutional issues with regard to determining where or limiting where a released person may or may not reside. And pursuant to the discussions in the House, it was decided that there's a clear constitutional differential between someone who is in a parole or temporary release situation, in which case they are under the charge of the Department of Corrections, and if they are between that and their being in a probationary situation, in which case they're under the charge of the courts. And from all the research that was done by counsel on the House side, it was determined that once you are in the charge of the Department of Corrections, as in the case in a parole or a temporary release situation, there is no real substantial constitutional issue of whether or not you may say you may live here or you may not live here. And that is actually why there was a clear decision not to include probation as a condition in either of these bills, because apparently that is where the constitutional line is drawn. But there was a substantial amount of discussion on that.
There's Frank.
Well, follow-up, and I don't want to take a whole huge amount of committee's time. I'm kind of lukewarm on this bill, as probably can be guessed. But as part of that legal discussion or research, I mean, wouldn't it be necessary to articulate some rational basis for treating these folks differently than anybody else? I mean, what is the reason that we tell a court that we need this bill? Why is this good public policy? Why do the people of the state of Oregon need this when we, as opposed to telling somebody who may be on parole or on temp leave, your right, which most citizens have, to choose your own residence is restricted?
At this stage of the questioning, I would probably feel more comfortable in having Representative Mannix or some competent counsel respond to that. And he is available for the purposes of today's hearing, because he's just across the way, or for a future hearing if you'd like to set this over. As I said, there was substantial discussion, part of which I was present for and part of which was just summarized to me.
Well, we'll get our counsel to kind of be in touch and check it out and see if we can collect those pieces efficiently from
Ms. Zucker has done that research, and maybe it's just a matter of reviewing a case or two, but there's a considerable question in my mind exists as to whether or not we can survive a challenge.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Shoemaker.
I wonder if it might not be desirable to give the district attorney or superintendent a little more leeway to waive this requirement than the bill gives. And in that respect, I would suggest two amendments. One, that under A, where it says inmate provides proof of a full-time job, that we eliminate the words full-time, so that if an inmate has any kind of a job, he can go where the job is. And, you know, more power to it. And then there ought to be a final clause which would, in rather general terms, allow other, you know, the superintendent to grant a waiver in other appropriate circumstances or something to that effect. So that
good cause shown or something.
Yeah. So I would move those, first specific amendment and second conceptual amendment, trusting that Jack in the appropriate language.
Any further discussion of Senator Shoemaker's conceptual comment?
I think it's a good idea.
Okay. no objections, we'll get Jack to work on that and be in touch with other parties and Senator Hill. You don't object?
No.
Okay. And we're doing this, one of the shells to May someplace around here. We have that ready. Okay, let's set House Bill 2357 and 2436 aside, assuming that whatever we do on one will also apply to the other, and we're agreed to use 57 as the model bill language. Okay, then let's take up 3099, and then we'll move to the public hearing on the rest of the bills. 3099 in work session, please.
House Bill 3099 in growth is the bill at the request of various members of the legislature. It has to do with classes of sexual offenses and has the effect of raising the classification of the crime in those instances where a person is convicted of rape, sodomy, or sexual penetration with a foreign object and the victim is incapable of consent by reason of mental defect, mental incapacitation, or physical hopelessness.
And I gather we have no
amendments.
No amendments on that. Pleasure of the committee.
I have a
Senator Shoemaker.
Question. One could imagine a situation where a man and a woman are living together, either married or unmarried, and the woman is permanently suffering from a mental defect that really makes her incapable of consenting to the sexual act one way or the other. And you wouldn't want to put the husband or companion in those circumstances to be in a position of committing a rape every time he has a sexual relationship with his wife.
Well, that's probably on one end of the spectrum.
That's the kind of stuff that law school essays examine. I'm not sure it's something we need to be concerned.
Well, what do you do?
Well, in this state, you can rape your wife, can't you?
Yeah. Pardon?
So in this state, you can rape your wife.
I know you can, and I think that's an appropriate law. Well, that
can you marry? This is probably a stupid question, but can people with these kinds of problems get married that would qualify as physical helplessness?
Well, that's a contract. You can't enter into a contract if you're in that condition, can you? Because marriage is a contract.
But you can certainly enter into a relationship.
Yeah.
And it, probably society is the better for it. Somebody caring for somebody, essentially. They wouldn't be prosecuted, I suppose, but it is seem a shame to make what they're doing a crime.
Well, there's actually
it is
some
now.
Kind of,
I mean, we're just.
Estimate.
It already is, and I guess we have to. I'm not aware of any case that's ever been filed by a district attorney's office or a true bill on a grand jury in these circumstances.
Fine.
There's a mens rea requirement here. I think, I mean, you got to show some type of malintent on the part of the. I don't know how we get to that. Well, we'll take a chance, Madam Chair. I'll move House Bill 3099 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Further discussion? Call the roll, Pat.
Bachman. Aye.
Senator
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much.
I read the question doesn't mean I know the answer.
Okay, now we're going to get down to real business here. Let's start. Call Senator Phillips. Where's Mason? It would be my preference to start with 2369 and 3015, I guess, sir. We've got people here. Great. Why don't we just go ahead and get Senator Phillips on the way, but those of you who are here to come, we've got 2369. Doug Hockelrode is here, Rosanna Creighton is here, and why don't you come on up, and we'll get Phillips, and he'll come in, and you can start without him.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Rosanna Creighton, Executive Director of Citizens for a Drug-Free Oregon. House Bill 2369 is identical to Senate Bill 456, a bill that was introduced at our request by Senator Paul Phillips and Representative Mike Burton, with 15 Senate co-sponsors and 38 House co-sponsors. We support legislation establishing a safety zone around our schools. We support House Bill 2369 and its sponsors. The fact that Oregon has become well known as a haven for drug manufacturers and dealers is readily recognized. Arresting this problem requires a comprehensive approach that treats both the supply side and demand side. Education of our youth and having parents set the example are the best weapons that we can use. Beyond this, enforcement against drug dealing is a powerful weapon. The first place we must create a safety zone from drug activity is around our schools. All elementary, junior high schools, including public, private, and parochial schools. Prevention and education will not protect our children from the destructive forces of illicit drugs unless we provide an environment that promotes the non-use of drugs and shields them from those who make money peddling drugs. I can't imagine a person in this room today that would say that we should not have a safety zone around our schools. Would there be anyone here who thinks our children should not be free to walk to school, be in school, play on the school grounds, and walk the halls of their school completely safe from being exposed to drug use, drug distribution, drug manufacturing, and trafficking? House Bill 2369 is the first step in showing that we will stand firm to protect our children. It is modeled after a federal statute. It is constitutional and is supported by educators and citizens alike. Oregon young people are vulnerable to the drug activities. Where there is a general downward trend in recent years in drug use by high school seniors nationally, Oregon students are not following that trend. Our students use illicit drugs earlier and more frequently than students do nationally. In just the past 2 years, daily use of marijuana by our eighth graders has increased 80%, and daily use of cocaine by our eighth graders has increased fourfold. We must increase our efforts and develop an intolerance to this problem. Oregon must send the message across the country that drug manufacturing, dealing, and use will not be tolerated any longer, especially within the safety zone of our schools. We must hang tough and be tough. The future of Oregon is at stake. House Bill 2369 is basic and necessary to the safety and well-being of our children. I urge this committee to quickly take action and pass House Bill 2369. I am here and I will stay during the testimony for questions. Perhaps you would like to ask them of me now or after our fine district attorney from Lane County testifies.
I have some questions, but they probably could well wait until we
go ahead. Vice Chairperson Hill and members of the committee. I'm Doug Harkle Road Lane, County's District Attorney and this year's President of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. You've all heard from Senator Hill and from myself in the past about the problems of drugs in our communities today. You've just heard more. I shan't go into that again. The DA's Association strongly supports House Bill 2369 and urges you to pass it. I'm available for questions.
Senator Schumer.
Yeah, thanks. It says except as authorized by, and then the references are to many sections of Chapter 475. Could you just kind of tell us some of the authorized situations where you can deliver a controlled substance?
Those, my, without going back and looking at those, my memory of that is that those are prescription type things where delivery is okay to give you substances. Cocaine used by a doctor is just fine.
Okay, I see.
Administered.
Yeah. Thank you. Good. Better term.
And what exactly is a controlled substance?
Controlled substance is a long list of chemicals that the Board of Pharmacy puts out. It's schedules 1, 2, 3, and 4, basically. And things can be added to that list or subtracted from that list. Very long list.
Is it, in addition to the drugs that we commonly think of and know as heroin, cocaine, and those, it would include a number of drugs that are normally used as prescription drugs but which can be abused, I would assume?
Yes. Yeah, I can't think of one right now, but I'm confident there are a number of drugs that are on that list.
So we'd be getting at all of those, too, regardless of how damaging they really are, I suppose. I mean, the controlled substance list are, I guess, they're chemical substances that are not supposed to be passed from person to person without a prescription.
Yeah, Valium is an example. Came to be there as you were talking. That's a controlled substance.
Is marijuana a controlled substance?
Yes.
Is one... less than 1 ounce of marijuana controlled substance?
Yes.
So this would make it a Class A felony to give somebody a joint, which is would now considered
a violation,
a civil violation, and that must occur frequently within 1,000 feet of certainly universities and adult schools. I wonder if it's really... Is it intended by this bill to get at that, to passing a joint to somebody within the vicinity of a university?
I should draw the committee's attention to the House